This is the Beat Your Genes podcast. My name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Ha, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during a show and ask a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751. Or you can send us a question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Today, Dr. Lyle is not with us. We were lucky enough to have Dr. Lyle solo last week, but this week we are lucky enough to have Dr. Jen Hawk with us solo. So, Dr. Hawk, how are you doing this evening?
I'm very well. How are you, Nate?
I'm doing just fantastic. We missed you the last two shows, but we're looking forward to getting your raw, unfiltered take on these questions this time.
Well, my raw, unfiltered take filtered through a little jet lag and international travel, so it should be very interesting.
Well, let's just hit the ground running and let's see what we come up with.
Okay, sounds like a plan.
All right. Our first question, I left this question for you, Dr. Hawk, because of your background in government and political science. And so this question starts off, "Dear doctors, I belong to a professional organization that has been working to root out genuine problems with racism, albeit in fits and starts. But lately, it feels as though the tone has devolved from one of problem solving to grievance seeking and grievance magnification. The communications have been hijacked by highly disagreeable or highly neurotic individuals, plus those who are gaining status as lead torchbearer. A few have said that they'd rather destroy the organization than be part of one which hasn't achieved their goals for diversity, even if said organization was doing good advocacy work for others. Is there any coming back from this? All the pleas for mutual respect and professionalism are decried as tone policing, and their originators are called enablers and bigots. Anything that I can do besides keeping my tongue tucked and eyes on my own work? Thank you for your thoughts, and I'm grateful for giving some psychological distance from this ongoing shit show."
Oh, this is an amazing question. This really sounds like a question that I could have written in a variety of contexts over the last several years of my professional life and academic life. I mean, this was my experience completely in the nonprofit sector, working in government and in academia, all three of those areas that I spent years each in. This was what I witnessed. And of course, you know, people who are following along at home know that this is largely what I wrote my dissertation about, involved a lot of these themes. So, you know, there's a lot to say about this and why it's happening, and, you know, to unpack various components of this. But just to give away the answer right at the beginning here, there is no coming back from this in your immediate life experience. So the ultimate takeaway from this question for the person who's actually asking it and trying to optimize their life circumstances is that you are in a situation that is not going to change. There are so many incentives in place, and those incentives are interacting with toxic personalities in a way that is going to create a very stable work environment for you that you cannot expect to significantly alter or change in any way that's going to improve your work experience. So if you have the kind of personality that can just keep your head down and your tongue tied and deal with it and complain about it when you get home, that's fine. Like, continue to do that. I hope they're paying you well. If you are not that kind of personality and this is causing you a lot of stress and you're like actively wondering what the hell is going on and you're trying to change the culture and you're just hitting your head against the wall and it's making you miserable, it's really time to think about getting out of this particular job. And if you're going to stay within the same kind of work, to at least migrate somewhere where it's a little less extreme in these ways that you're describing. But generally, if you're involved in any kind of advocacy work like this, you're going to find this kind of environment, because this is the hegemonic environment that you're going to find in anti-racism organizations, any kind of advocacy organization. This just is what it is right now, because of the culture and the incentives that have emerged and that are firmly in place. And that's not anything that's going to change anytime soon. So for your own life, for your own happiness, for your own experience, which are all the things that we want to be elevating into the center of how we are making choices and going about living our lives, you got to get out. You can't sit there and expect it to change on you. And you are not going to change it by convincing anybody. So that's the takeaway. The larger picture here is that, you know, you've got to step back and look at this from the point of view of what people are really up to and what's incentivizing their behavior. And if there's anything that you can count on in this world, it's that people are doing two things above all else. They are maniacally pursuing status. You know, they're pursuing status. They're pursuing displays to confirm their status, and they're trying to do it as cheaply and with as many shortcuts as possible. So in this kind of situation where you've got all of the status dynamics that are always going to be present in any kind of, I'm assuming this is some sort of nonprofit, not a governmental job, although I guess it could be both. You've got people that are trying to achieve status and therefore create a display that is the most righteous display possible, because you're engaged in righteous work, and it is, you know, it's anti-racism. You're rooting out these grievances. So the incentives for the display is, you know, the person who is the sort of most upset and the most righteous wins the whole game. So this is a race for people to engage in those displays that reflect that situation, both within the organization and external to it. So that fundamental truth is also not going to change about this particular place. And then you also have people with the conservation of energy. They're seeking that display. They're seeking that status, but they're trying to be as shortcutty and lazy about it as possible. So they're relying on the easiest, most conventional scripts and the most accessible ways to do this, which are all of these things that we see that are shared across this world. So there are particular little scripts that you will see followed by actors in all of these different sectors, and they all kind of look the same, and they're all similarly off-putting to people who are in this position, who are looking at the dynamics from the perspective that you are. So I don't know what to tell you other than you've got to look at your life and how you're using your hours. We are always coming back to the 100,000 hour rule. You have a short life. You have limited time on this planet. You only get to use your time once, as far as we know. Even those of us with the mystic chip have to hold our reincarnation beliefs. We have to keep those at bay while we're thinking about how we actually want to live the life that we are experiencing this moment. And for my hours, I would not want to be wasting any of my time and energy in an environment where my talent and my contributions and my insights and my work in general are generally just going to be wasted. So that's what I would generally say, but we can dig further into it if you want.
Yeah, this is a really, really interesting way to describe what's going on. And the first thing that I thought of, like when you concluded this whole thing, is that this question, this listener, obviously, I don't know for sure, but it sounds like solving these issues and displaying this type of righteousness feels like the best use of her energy for her particular personality traits or his particular trip personality traits.
Mm-hmm.
And so from what it sounds like is you're saying in this time of the world, in this particular case, these people and these organizations that do this are... I don't know what I'm trying to say. I guess it's
yeah.
Yeah.
I'm picking up what you're putting down. Like I have lived this life where I have been authentically, genuinely motivated, you know, from politics, personal politics and personal commitments to social justice and to social ideals that, for lack of a better word, we could call progressive or leftist. You know, my personal politics have shifted toward a more sort of libertarian zone as I have become more of a hard-boiled evolutionary psychologist, because just I so cherish the idea of personal liberty filtered through the idea of evolutionary psychology. Once you really start to embrace the psychology of it, I think the politics inevitably follow. So there are actually a lot of, that's another thing I would say to this questioner, is that I talk to a lot of clients and there are a lot of people who are experiencing exactly this situation. So I live through it. I know many people I have talked to have lived through it who are currently in situations just like this, where they have strong commitments to social justice or something that we might call social justice. They want to improve the world. They want to help the most vulnerable people. They want to create more equitable conditions for people who are genuinely struggling. Like, this is all really laudable, beautiful goals in the world. But then they run into these bureaucratic nightmares and these situations where they are in some kind of unholy status derby with a bunch of assholes who are elbowing each other out of the way to prove how righteous they are compared to how righteous someone else is, how they're a better ally.
At the cost of the mission. Right.
Yeah, at the cost of the mission, right. It becomes a personal status contest that is masked by a mission of an organization. And this is just, I started to see the shift begin to occur like as early as the late 1990s, with a lot of sort of undoing institutional racism and the diversity programs and all of these things that began with just the best of intentions. Just, you know, absolutely were these places were trying to, even within organizations that had a different kind of agenda, they were addressing valid concerns of representation and equity and you know, equal access and all of these things that are absolutely important to address and that needed to be dealt with in some manner. But it has become a runaway status process where the you know, people are going to be people, personalities are going to be personalities, and you cannot stop the status seeking. And the institutional equilibrium that emerges from relentless shortcutting status seeking is one of this kind of, as the questioner uses one of my favorite words, it's a shit show. It really is. And I have not, it has been probably over a decade since I have run into any kind of nonprofit advocacy environment that is not afflicted by this. And there are a lot of long-term institutional reasons for this. Jordan Peterson, who we've talked about on the podcast before, psychologist and professor at the University of Toronto, he speaks much more eloquently about this than I ever could. He really traces the history of the emergence of the idea of postmodernism, this academic idea that was the spawn of Marxism, and how it was born in the academy, and you had this whole generation of particularly academics in the humanities embracing this doctrine of postmodernism, and how that dogma, and postmodernism, for anybody who's not heard about it or heard of it, is essentially, it's neo-Marxism. There are oppressed and oppressors, and you are one or the other. There's really nothing in between. And therefore, every institution, every organization, every act, every the way that you look at somebody, the way that you talk to somebody is either oppressive or you are being oppressed. And there are a lot of, you know, postmodern specialists who would attack me for being too simplistic about that, but I really would stand behind that analysis. That is really what it comes down to. And so that becomes, that starts to inform all academic thinking about these kinds of problems, and over the course of about two decades, it infects bureaucracies, advocacy organizations, and government itself, just policymaking in general. And so this is ubiquitous. It is the water that we are swimming in. If you are concerned about social justice questions, and it's why you see a huge amount of pushback on the other side of the question with people who are becoming progressively alienated and disgusted by this kind of environment and feeling like they don't know how they can apply their talents and help without being labeled an oppressor, which is, you know, a very disincentivizing kind of place to find yourself if you've devoted your life to trying to root out and address these problems from a very authentic place in your heart and soul. It's really, like, I have so much sympathy for this question because this is exactly the process that I went through.
And so, yeah, you advise, you know, your advice is to essentially get out of the situation because there's no turning back. You know, I guess there's implications for this because, you know, the person may have spent an entire career or several years, you know, essentially getting the tools and skills that they thought they needed to do this. And sure. So what would be a long-term solution for somebody who still wants to stay in this type of field, but may not want to be in the shit show?
Yeah. I mean, I think it is hitting this critical tipping point where there are enough career specialists and bureaucrats and organizers who are in the situation that they're just like you have the so-called intellectual dark web, which is the place where academics who are in the situation are congregating. So academics are in the same situation. If you're an academic and you are not buying into this worldview, and you're struggling with it in the way that this questioner and that I have, you have two choices. You get completely out of academia, which is what I've done, or you find some kind of place, you find like-minded people, you build your personal utopia in a way that allows you to speak the truth about these issues and to find like-minded souls. And so the shortcut term for that, which describes a very amorphous thing, this is not an actual website or place that you can go, but it's the idea that there is a parallel intellectual space on the internet, and occasional discussions about actually creating universities and mimicking new institutional processes that are free of these kinds of dynamics. But none of that has happened as far as I know. But that's what I would advise this person to look into. I don't know specifically for the issue area that they're working in, if that exists. I would assume that it does, though, just based on my perception of how many people I've talked to who feel this way and who are experiencing exactly that feeling of, oh my God, I went to college for this. I spent, you know, decade or more building my career, and now I feel like an outsider looking in. I feel rejected by my own organization and what I'm trying to do. And my work is completely devalued. And that's a terrible place to try to live your life and try to fight your way through that. And you know, some, like, just going back to the personality question, that it's workable for certain personalities. If you're an extremely conscientious person who is essentially just leaving your work at the office, and you keep your head down and you do your business and you do your little chunk of the job, and you can go home and leave it alone, that's fine. But that's not true for most people who are drawn to this kind of work. Most people who are drawn to social justice type work are people who want to change the world. They want to improve things. They want to really make a difference. And they're living that at every level of their life, both at work and at home and in their private life. So it becomes inescapable. And it sucks. It really does. But this, you can't fall into the sunk cost fallacy with the idea that, oh, I've invested so much time and so I got to stick it out and I can't just dump it now because I've put so much time into it. For the same reason that you can't do that with a shitty relationship. If you're in a bad relationship, oh, we have so much history together can be a very convincing argument, like, oh, I don't want to give up on it. But the fact is, you've got to take life on its terms in the moment. And if things have changed, and if the CB has changed, and it is no longer a situation where you're optimizing your time and energy and living the best possible life you can in the limited time that you have, then you gotta cut your losses. And if you don't, then you're paying the cost. You're just living a compromised life, and we don't want to be in that situation if we can help it. But I recognize that there's going to be a lot of personality variation. There's going to be a lot of variation about how extreme these situations are. Some people are going to be in an environment where it's so relentless and they are just not able to say anything without being sent to re-education camp, and then other people who are, their perspective is still somewhat valued and it's a little more balanced. So there's going to be variation. And all I would say is that you've got to try to find the best possible place that you can find. It doesn't sound like you currently are in that organization, though.
I can see how people can be pretty discouraged, you know, after finding this out. But I can also see how they can be pretty uplifted after hearing your explanation on it, because I know that I've met people who are discouraged in this manner. And the nice people that they are, they start thinking, well, what is it that I'm not doing correctly? Or what am I doing that, what can I do better?
Sure. Well, and I think even before you get there, it's, you know, because this is the water everybody's swimming in, you don't, without having the external view of the larger dynamics of what's going on, it does feel you start to to internalize. It's ironic because postmodernism talks a lot about the idea of internalized oppression. So a lot of these power structures that we're dealing with in terms of people who are more vulnerable and the oppressed, they don't even realize how oppressed they are because the language itself and all the microaggressions and everything else are conferring this power hierarchy in visible and invisible ways. And so the irony of this is that these people who are committed to trying to improve the world, who are working in these organizations, it's like a frog in a pot of boiling water where they're being told again and again and again that they are, you know, they're tone policing or they're enabling or that they have internalized racism that they need to undo themselves and they need to go to yet another training to understand that and to recognize how they're exercising their privilege in ways that they don't understand. And so it becomes, if you are a conscientious person and especially a conscientious, agreeable person who has these kind of commitments, it's almost invisible to you the broader process that is happening, because you are going to blame yourself. You are going to say, oh, well, God, if everybody's telling me this, then you know, they must be right. And I really do need to re-examine my privilege and re-examine all of my microaggressions and all of the ways that I am contributing to the problem. This is just, it really is a total runaway process where it's the disagreeable, highly unstable people, like I think is pointed out in the question. Those are the people that rise in this kind of status hierarchy. It is a terrible, ironic, bizarre, weird situation, but that's who you find at the head of these organizations is unstable disagreeables, and who are just tyrannical and have armies of conscientious people trying to do the right thing by them, and trying to do the right thing by the cause and by the mission. But really, it has become the empire of these disagreeable people who are inflicting their worldview on everybody. So, yeah, I just you gotta live your life. You've got to get out.
Yeah, it sounds like they're exploiting a loophole in human psychology.
Exactly, a couple of different loopholes.
Those ends of the bell curve people.
Exactly, and I think they don't know that that's what they're doing. They are just, you know, operating under basic human scripts to seize status and to conserve energy and to express personality in the most accurate display possible. So if you're a disagreeable, unstable person, no better display than being at the top of some, you know, big advocacy organization that's really upset about all of the grievances and all of the injustices in the world. Like, what better way
to disagreeability?
Exactly. And it's like that is, of course, where those people are going to land if that funnel exists for them. But the problem is that it becomes contaminated by this social justice mission that attracts people who are trying to affect some kind of major change in the world. And so you run into this circle of disagreeableness, and it's a terrible place to wind up. And it took me a long time to separate out these broader processes, and evolutionary psychology was invaluable in actually detecting what was going on and getting myself out of that whole web, both in academia and the nonprofit world. So I wish this person great luck. I don't know offhand, you know, of organizations that might be less shitty that they could move into, but I don't doubt that they do exist, because I do think I don't think that the tide is truly turning and that you're going to see a huge pendulum shift on this, but I do think you're going to see pockets of, normalcy and people who are just bell curve wise, less disagreeable, less unstable, who are still trying to affect some change in the world and do some good. And so just seek those people out and try to live your life accordingly.
Mm-hmm. And don't get or start any long contracts.
Right. Yeah, no, definitely not. And don't be afraid to break a long contract. I mean, again, like, check your conscientiousness. These conscientious people have to be aware that they are, you know, especially if you've got the full sucker triad going on, that just because you're in some kind of contract, if you're in a contract in this kind of situation with terrible people and you're hating your life and you're hating your job, you've got to beat your genes. You've got to beat those conscientious genes. And, you know, as a lawyer friend of mine used to say, contracts are made to be broken. Leases are made to be broken. You know, it's like, that's why they exist. And so if you need help navigating that, you can talk to us or talk to a lawyer or just find your way out. But there's always a way out. It just might come at some cost. But, you know, you've got to accurately weigh that cost against the cost of flushing days and weeks and years of your life down the toilet in service to some disagreeable tyrant who is running an organization that you don't believe in anymore.
Mm-hmm. And in the same way that some medical interventions out there don't really increase survival advantage or don't really have the stated goal or they don't really change much.
Right.
It sounds like some of these organizations don't really change much anyway.
They don't change shit.
God forbid we ever find a way to measure objectively whether or not that actually happens.
Yeah, they don't change anything. They exist to justify themselves. And so they exist to justify themselves. They exist to, maintain the position and the status of the people in charge and the board members. And they're self-perpetuating displays for disagreeable, unstable maniacs, largely. I don't want to completely throw the nonprofit sector under the bus, but this is what it largely is. I've worked for wonderful nonprofits with really good people in charge, really great board of directors, people who are doing really important work, everybody who's there for the right reasons. But more often, I've worked for exactly the kind of dynamic that's being described in this question. And it took me a long time to build enough of a correlational analysis where I started to see the writing on the wall early enough to either stay entirely away from those organizations or certainly to avoid getting myself too dependent on them. More than a contract, you want to be making sure that you're just not in a position of weakness. You want to be sure that you can get out of there. You can do something else. I mean, I really think for people who are truly making themselves miserable in a situation like this, it's better to go work at Starbucks than to keep punching the clock, even if you're taking a huge pay cut. Your time is your time. It's all you've got. And better to have a crappy minimum wage job that you can leave at work and actually go home and enjoy your existence than something that is just poisoning every minute of your day and undermining your happiness so profoundly. But that's my egocentric bias talking. Everybody's in their own position with their own personality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Dr. Lila said before that happiness is earned you want to earn esteem from the people
yes,
that matter.
The people, the right way, the right kind of esteem in the right way from the people who matter. So that's always, you want to be running your esteem seeking against that metric, because conscientious people, I mean, I'm one of you. I've been in this trap so many times, and I've been in a trap where I've been just desperate, beating my head against the wall, seeking esteem from some authoritarian tyrant at the head of some organization that I don't actually want to be devoting my life to. And they're never going to give it. They're never going to give you the status that
it's
you
never
want.
Enough.
They may give you, they may,
enough.
Yes. Yeah. This is the situation where you're a conscientious nutcase for whom you never feel like what you're doing is good enough, just because that's how you're wired. That's what conscientiousness is. You never feel like you've done enough. You never feel like you've given your best. And your internal audience is chirping away at you that you need to do more, you need to work harder, you need to stay later, you need to examine your privilege more accurately. And then you're in a dynamic where you're working for some asshole for whom nothing is ever good enough. So this is a perfect storm of personalities where it's just like, what a nightmare. It is set up for misery. And this is why these places are able to sustain themselves for so long. Conscientious person just doggedly continues, you know, plodding away, trying to do the right thing. And the disagreeable person at the top just continues to take advantage of that and exploit them until finally the conscientious person has just had enough or is presented with some kind of low-cost alternative that they can jump to. But this is why we call the show Beat Your Genes. So you like, once you know what's going on with the dynamic, you just have to really look at it and really run the cost on defection. And there will be a cost, but it's going to be, in many cases, less than staying, just like it would be in a relationship. I mean, this is a relationship. It's a relationship with the boss. It's a relationship with coworkers. And, you know, defection is always an option. They can't really stop you, as Harry Brown says. Nobody can actually really stop you.
Maybe Dr. Hawk, that'll be one of your quotes. People in the Facebook group once in a while will put a quote up from you or Dr. Lyle. Rarely me, but you and Dr. Lyle. I think defection is always an option. Quote.
Yeah. Hawk. We've been talking about making T-shirts, and that could be one of them. The other one that we want to do is like it's the word process with a line over outcome. So process over outcome. So we'll get some T-shirts going. We'll get some Esteem Dynamics wear for all the cool kids. To, you know, calibrate their display properly.
Yeah.
Be a little nod that we're all in the intellectual dark web together.
A little like a fifth column, you know.
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah. All right. Our next question. Dr. Lyle has mentioned the concept of internal ugliness a couple of times in previous shows. How does one go about identifying their own internal ugliness and then mitigating or correcting it?
Internal ugliness is, I'm not sure I have heard him mention that, but I have been on the road for the past couple of months and I'm not totally caught up in all the shows I haven't been on. So did he mention that recently? What is that referring to?
You know, I'm not sure either. I couldn't remember that exact term, but I suspected when I saw this question that maybe it had something to do with, he mentioned a few shows back where he said that Dr. Hawk likes to talk about, likes to stage personality. She calls it personality cancer and how you like to stage it. So I'm not sure, but I thought it had something to do with that. So unless I'm wrong, but maybe we can hear your thoughts on personality cancer.
Yeah. The only other thing that comes to mind is the myth of inner beauty, but it doesn't sound like that's what it's about. Personality cancer, I do like to assign stages and say things like personality cancer is, you know, it can't be cured. It can only be managed. So especially when you start getting into the later stages. So yeah, well, personality as you know, I'm always trying to drive home is fixed. It is genetic. It is immutable. It is you are kind of stuck with the personality that you have. And so is everybody else. This does not mean that your personality cannot express itself differently under different constraints and incentives. So this is where people tend to get really confused because people will observe their own history and their own existence and they feel like they have changed and that they're not as disagreeable as they used to be, or they're more conscientious than they used to be, or they're more introverted than they used to be. And all of these things are true to the degree that you've gone through your life process and you've had certain personality attributes that place you at certain points in the bell curve, but you have gained experience and you have formed increasingly fine-tuned correlations about how the world works. So if X, then Y, you know, you go out into the world. So introversion, take introversion as an example. This is one that I've experienced and is very common with people that I talk to where they say, I used to be so much more outgoing. I used to really enjoy going out more and meeting people. And now I'm just a shut-in and I'm so isolated and people feel like this is a problem and they go to some psychodynamic therapist who tells them that it's a problem and that they need to change and they need to open themselves up to more interactions and go out and experience the world again. But this is not what's happening. This is not a pathology. What is happening is that you are at baseline pretty introverted. But in your younger years, you were gathering information about how the world worked. And so whatever extroversion you did have in your personality was taking you out and seeking to build correlations about how worth it was to have interactions with other people. And the more interactions you had with people, the better you got at anticipating how any given interaction was going to go earlier in the experience. So you got to a point at some point where you're like, yeah, there's only so many kinds of people in the world, and you can kind of start to get the cues about 2 minutes into any given conversation with any of them about whether it's going to be worthwhile or not. You don't have that knowledge when you're first starting out in life. So it's just there's a lot more noise in the data, so you're going to invest more time and energy less accurately than you will as you go through and you accumulate the correlations, which is just another way of describing wisdom. You're getting wiser over time. So your personality doesn't change. Just the sloppiness of your use of your time and energy changes. You're sloppier with it when you're younger, because you know less about what to expect. And this works both ways. So the only cost-benefit analysis that you're making on any given use of your time and energy is not omniscient. You never actually know the true nature of reality. All you know is the information that you're working under. And that information usually tends toward accuracy over time. As people have more experiences and they meet more people and they do more things, the general direction of the process is that you get better calibrated, you get wiser, you get older and wiser, is where the axiom comes from. But it can work in the reverse, where you get distorted, you get some kind of distorted information, and then you confirm that bias over and over and over again. And you get progressively more confused, and there's more noise in your analysis, and your cost-benefit analysis gets sort of worse and worse and worse, and you continue to misuse your time and energy. That's usually going to happen because somebody has had some very unusual experience or set of experiences that has contributed to that kind of misinformation that is buffered for that long a period of time. Much more often, people are just getting older and wiser and recalibrating. So the personality does not change. You get the genetic allocation that you get of the big five when you're born, that is written into your genetic code, and everybody's got some level of unpleasantness in there. Nobody has a perfect personality. When we talk about a perfect personality, we're always following that up with, a perfect personality for what? Because you could be a super agreeable, highly conscientious, extroverted, open to experience, but not too open to experience, really highly stable person. And that sounds like a pretty perfect personality, pretty ideal person. But that kind of person is going to get themselves into a sucker triad situation. They're going to get exploited by a shitty boss. They might be in a little bit of trouble with the pleasure trap. Like, there are pitfalls for any personality, no matter how ideal it might look on paper. So there is an ecological niche for every personality distortion. Like, every extreme on any bell curve of the big five is going to find a happy little home with regard to any particular problem. So that's why we're trying to control the environment, not change the individual. And so when we talk about personality cancer, I'm usually talking about extreme distortions in personality, distortions on the bell curve that are putting you at a point where you are finding it systematically very difficult to beat the genes because you are so beholden to that distortion. This is most common with people who are extremely conscientious. So hyper, hyper conscientious nutcases, it's almost impossible for them to step back from that conscientiousness and do the quote right thing for their happiness instead of serving the interests of their conscientiousness, because the pull of the conscientiousness is so unbelievably strong. So I am lucky enough, my genes put me right at like the 90th percentile for conscientiousness, which is very high, but not so high that I fall all the time into that trap. I fall into it often, but I've got enough flakiness, thanks Dad, that I can like step back from a really bad situation. My dad was a Jimmy, he's like an addict Jimmy, guitar playing, organ playing, total gave me me wonderfully flaky genes. My mom is super conscientious, super like on the ball. Like it's yeah, I got the best of both worlds. So, but the flakiness saves me. So the super conscientious people fall into this trap. Super disagreeable people also fall into a personality cancer trap where it's like they cannot step back far enough to reflect on how distorted their worldview really is. They can't see the forest for the trees. You know, they are stuck in this worldview of how unfair things are and how discontented they are and how they're getting a raw deal and they're getting chiseled and it's just totally unfair. And if you're so extreme on one of these curves, it becomes progressively more and more difficult to beat the genes. So that's what we're talking. If you're so far out, especially with some kind of emotional process of like disagreeableness and instability, for example, that's going to be what we're going to call personality cancer. Because that is a tough thing to have to deal with. You can be aware that it exists, but actually mitigating it in the moment and making a different choice than your CB is trying to produce behind those personality distortions is incredibly difficult. If you are a person with that kind of personality cancer who listens to this podcast, you're in a better position than most because you've got the IQ to take a larger view of it and to develop that discernment and what we might call mindfulness, for lack of a better word, to be less reactive and less beholden to your personality distortion in the moment. But really, when we're talking about personality cancer, we're talking about like the earlier question where this person who's working in this work environment is dealing with unreflective people with extreme personality distortion who not only can't change their CB on that behavior, but have no interest in it, have no self-reflection in them at all, maybe don't have the IQ to even think about having that self-reflection. So if you're in a situation where you're in particularly a position of weakness with somebody who has some kind of extreme personality distortion and an utter lack of reflectiveness about it, and unwillingness to you know, not to change because they're not going to change, but to talk about how the environment might be altered to express that personality differently, that is a situation where you're dealing with somebody with stage 4 personality cancer, and it's best just to give them a wide berth and make different choices for your life.
Mm-hmm. Now, if someone can identify that they have that high disagreeable, high unstable personality cancer, should they then start a political organization?
Are you asking for a friend, Nate?
No. I don't think I'm that disagreeable.
No.
I think Dr. Lyle said I was like 55-40, no. Or 60-40, I think he said.
You're totally not that disagreeable.
But
yeah.
But I'm just making a joke about our previous question.
No, it's totally, totally valid. They should go start some kind of cult because that's their niche. That's where they belong is, you know, being the little tyrant, the little king in their own captive audience. And that is what those people will naturally do. I mean, you'll see them do that, you know, commensurate with their IQ. If they have a higher IQ, they are going to have their own little political organization, their own little nonprofit. They're going to run for office. If they have less IQ, they're going to be the shitty assistant manager at the store that they work at, you know, where they run the place like their own little prison camp. And it just, this happens all the way up and down the bell curve, no matter where people wind up. Personality cancer does not discriminate by SES, you know, it is all over the place. So yeah, you just always have to have your eyes open and be, you know, picking your, we call it your personal utopia. Your personal utopia is determined above all by the people that you're spending your time with. And so you want to be spending time with people who are good for your personality. And if you are an agreeable, that means, giving disagreeables plenty of disagreeable distance. If you're conscientious, it means, you know, also staying away from disagreeables who are going to try to exploit you, particularly low conscientious disagreeables. It just totally depends on your particular ecology and where you're at and what your goals are. But you got to know who you are and where you have some extremes in your personality, because if you don't, you're flying blind. And you're going to systematically make the wrong kinds of choices and find yourself in environments where you think you can improve them, or you can change people, or you can somehow change other people's CB by convincing them, and none of those things are possible. You're just, everything is all of these environmental dynamics are incredibly stable because the personalities that have created those environmental dynamics are incredibly stable. And that just is the way that it is. So the sooner people can accept that about themselves and about the people that they're spending their time with, the better their lives are going to be in the long run.
Absolutely brilliant, Dr. Hawk. Thank you so much. We probably offended all of the disagreeable and unstable people, which I'm totally fine with.
There is a place in everyone's life for disagreeable unstables. Like, I free ride on disagreeable people all the time. As a hyper agreeable person, I need disagreeable people in my life to do the dirty work for me. And I value them highly for that. So, you're one of them, Nate. You know, I've been in situations before where I'm like, I don't have the balls to complain about something. And so I'll just text you and be like, Nate, can you call the airline for me? And so this is, I never want to imply for 1 minute that there is any particular personality attribute that is out of bounds. There's a place for every point on the bell curve, every particular interaction. There's always a place where that belongs and can be very productive and useful. So it's just about finding what those are and finding complements to your own deficiencies and your own liabilities and partnering and spending time with the people who most complement and best optimize what is best about you.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.